Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 8. I have four streams for you this evening. Hold on a second. I'll just tell you who's coming up. In 2 hours, it will be Golden Age Man, then Horace, and then Giant Art Productions. But first, it's Martin Lichtmas. Now, I should say that every year I know that no matter how good the guests are that I manage to secure, none of them will best Martin Lichtmas. I have to watch them, each one of them trying to be insightful and witty and charismatic, and none of them come close to beating Martin Lichtmas. So, Martin, welcome back to Millennial.
Hi, thank you. Now you put some performance anxiety into me because...
Oh, no, I'm only joking. Don't worry.
Now I have the best. Oh, yeah, I have a bit of a cold. I have to apologize for this ugly pullover, but it's effective. You know, I'm freezing against Putin. This is the slogan we have here. So I can turn on the, the heat. Otherwise, I go bankrupt. So I just have here a Norwegian pullover or something. Yeah. I've created some halo backlight.
So. Yes, it's very nice. It's very nice. It gives a sense of warmth, which I guess is misleading.
Which never comes across with me, you know.
I'm sorry that you're enduring the cold, but I mean that does get us to the matter of Ukraine and Nord Stream and all that. But you said that you weren't keen on talking about that. Last year we talked. Well, the year before that we talked about COVID. Then last year we talked about all of that, the World Economic Forum and so on. And this is a matter that's, I think, very important to both you and me, and we talk about it a lot off stream, off camera. What would you say about this year, just in summary, before we get into the actual matter? Mm-hmm. How would you summarize this year?
Yeah, I guess I have to start with some update. What happened ever since? You know, last year when we talked, it was a terrible winter of discontent as far as all the COVID policies went. And you may remember that in Austria, our glorious government had the idea to introduce a general vaccine mandate. It was decided in November. I mean, it was announced in November, decided in January, and no other country has done it. I mean, they had vaccine mandates for certain professions, hospitals, but they introduced the general vaccine mandate. And I'm pretty sure we must have talked about it last year. Situation was, I think, was nightmarish in Austria. I mean, things were very heated up. People were angry at each other. There were huge protests. And even though there were considerations how the hell the government is going to enforce this, I felt it was a serious situation. It was very unpleasant. And I remember I started rereading the famous Forest Passage by Ernst Jünger, which is this book he wrote about survival in totalitarian regimes. And I have read this book before, but some parts hit me really hard because I thought, okay, this might be getting serious. Huh? And as far as I could tell, most people were taking it serious. Huh? And at the beginning of the year, I did consult a few doctors I knew that were critical of all this. Their reactions were quite different. I mean, one told me, no, don't worry, this will not work out, this will implode, you know. And there was another one who very early in the beginning, in February 2020, he already released some videos where he said, people calm down, this is not the bubonic plague. And so I asked him, and he would say things like, this is a war against us human beings. and it's too late to resist. And he told me that he was about to leave the country and he saw no chance at all. So, and then next thing that happened was the Ukraine war. All of a sudden, COVID was gone.
Well, before we get to that, the situation last December was really scary. And I remember you in Austria and Germany, and I remember you being genuinely, it's easy to forget this. And I think we shouldn't forget this because it matters. There was this atmosphere of, as you say, creeping totalitarianism, pointless. And you know, people sometimes romanticize the idea of totalitarianism, but the reality of it is you're following pointless rules. You're obeying, you're having to kowtow to idiots who have got some authority, and nothing makes much sense. And the regime doesn't need to make things make sense because it has this attitude of just everyone will do whatever they're fucking told to do. So there's a breakdown between, and I'm not saying this is always the case, but it's definitely the case there. There was a breakdown between the public and the thinking public and the powers that be. And that's a very scary situation. And we had it in Britain as well. Mm-hmm. But the British government were more libertarian, a bit more laissez-faire than the German and Austrian governments. And I really felt sorry. I mean, it was still the same bullshit going on. Still the same lying and twisting of data, misuse of data, inventing of data. All of that was still going on, but it was not as, but the policy prescriptions were not as thorough in Britain as they were in Austria. So I wasn't surprised that you were, you know, quite depressed about it. And I'm sorry that you went through that. And it did extend into this year. I mean, I remember it was still going on quite late on. But then in America and Britain, Omicron seemed to deflate the whole thing somewhat. And I remember you talking about that. Do you want to say anything about Omicron?
Yeah, I'll first address the things you said here. I mean, definitely some of the useless rules are still going on in Austria, here in Vienna, which is insane. I mean, the rest of the country has abandoned them mostly, but here in Vienna we have a social democrat government who thinks it's very clever to keep on, let's say, mask mandates in public transport and a few other things. And by now it's very obvious they're just keeping him up to save face because they were playing, you know, very hard, very strict. I mean, was useless. I mean, by now everybody, I guess most people who think, know this was absolutely useless and overblown and irrational. But here in Vienna, they keep going. And I think they have to last until spring, until they can drop it and save face. I think this is what's happening. But there's a lot of damage being done. If you force people to obey irrational things, you do a lot of damage to them and their psyche. And I can see it every day. I can see it every day. And this was a shocking thing that, I mean, of course, lots of people were angry. There were huge protests. But I think the majority of the people would just go along and obey rules you not don't question. And some of them are really no-brainers. I mean, I could tell you dozens of stories which are mind-blowingly crazy, huh? And people get aggressive when you question them or ask them or think of them. I mean, so this is something that was scary. And what also was scary was the media anger, fury. Almost all media were speaking with one voice. They were had these headlines scaring people every day. When the protests came, they tried to defame the protesters. Everybody was a neo-Nazi or a conspiracy theorist, a terrorist or whatever. So it was a very, very heated, aggressive thing. And it also extended into personal relationships. And I had a few experiences. I don't remember if I talked about it last year. There's especially one friend I had a fallout with. I have been known him for 30 years, and he's a, a doctor. I mean, psychiatrist, okay. And he went insane about the COVID mandates, and he would diagnose me. You know, I would write him very thoughtful mails where I said why I'm not for it. And he would like diagnose me and say, Martin, you are an egotist, narcissist, and because of you, people have to die. You know? And I wrote him back, okay, explain to me how. This is a skill I don't know. How can I make people die?
Yeah.
How am I doing it? You know, explain.
This is an interesting thing because I saw it with Sam Vaknin as well, where he was, and I've always been suspicious of Sam Vaknin. I've always had a bad feeling about that guy. And, you know, he said something like, in fact, I can actually find it for you right now.
I know what you're talking about. I remember this very well.
Here it is.
Yes, I do remember this. Huh?
And it was similar. Similar to what your friend said. This is Sam Vaknin. Unlike anti-vaxxing, vaccine hesitancy is legitimate, but beware. Information is not knowledge. Critical thinking and misinformation research is not hoarding. I don't know what he was saying there. Virulent confluence, and he's very verbose. Virulent confluence of conspiracy theories and victimhood movements. That's a whole sentence there. Conspiracy theorists such as anti-vaxxers are mentally ill. Conspiracism and pareidolia, paranoid ideation, anxiety, depression, delusionality and impaired reality testing, grandiosity and anti-intellectualism, truthiness, anti-expertise, malignant egalitarianism, sacred body, contumacious defiance.
All right.
There's a list of bollocks there.
No, I remember it, and even the verbosity itself is very suspicious. And everybody knows this guy is a self-confessed narcissist. He's a huge asshole. Just look at him. Look at him talk. Hear him talk. He's an absolute horrible asshole. And this is certainly the mindset of, you know, in Soviet Union, they put dissidents into psychiatry because, I mean, you must be insane not to believe in communism, or it's science, you know. This is what they claimed in Soviet Union, communist countries, that Marxism is science, you know. And if you don't follow it, you must be insane.
You've got to trust the science.
Trust the science. Follow the science. And my friend is not an asshole at all. Not at all. I mean, he's also a person I thought I was 100% sure I could rely on him all the time. I mean, even if we had disagreements, he wouldn't be so nasty or sarcastic. And we did have a few agreements in the past. And also, he's a reasonable person usually. Completely insane. But the story had an arc. So it was like a year later, you know, just a month ago, I texted him after we had some, you know, we decided to leave this, and maybe one day we meet face to face and talk, but not go into it anymore. And so I text him and I write to him, okay, a year later, is your opinion about the mandates the same as it used to be a year ago? And he says, he wrote back no, and asked him, okay, fine, why? And then he goes on to explain to me that vaccinations do not stop infections. And I said to him, listen, this is the same thing I told you a year ago. If you were following the science, actually, you knew that the vaccines didn't stop infections. And this was one reason to be against the mandates. There were several other reasons why the mandates were just, you know. But I had no apology from him. I mean, I wrote this back to him. I said, fine, this is what I told you a year ago. And you just, you know, insulted me. And so I have no excuse, not anything. And so I see even the most hardcore people seem to, you know, calm down. And you see. And in the meantime, yeah.
Go on.
Yeah, no, you go on.
I was going to say, the same certainty, the same arrogance, intellectual arrogance that caused them to be so aggressive then, now causes them to be unable to apologize for it. It's the same thing, really. They'll even admit that, yeah, I was wrong, but I'm not going to apologize.
Yeah, for me, it was a serious disappointment, and I told to him, "You owe me a duel in the Prater at dawn, you know, as they used to do in the monarchy 120 years ago." So I will get to that, you know, so he will not escape. But I see he's changing his mind. Lots of other people are as well. And, I mean, what further happened? I mean, so to continue the story arc, you know, in February, the chip was removed. Then everybody was looking at, Putin was now the evil one and Ukraine war. But also the Omicron thing happened. You mentioned it, you know, I mean, it was a huge, lots of great replacements of the old virus variant, and it went very fast in many countries, and Omicron didn't do much, and it also the vaccine wasn't working against it, so you had peak infections all of a sudden, but at the same time, no, not so many, less people died, there were less hospitalizations, so much more was happening on the level of infections, but on level of actual sickness, not so much was happening, but the vaccine at this point proved to be, you know, useless. So this was done. Attention was removed to the war. And in March, the government announced that the vaccine mandate will be sort of put aside. No, they will not enforce it. They hadn't enforced it. And look, I mean, I don't know how they would have done it. I think it would have been impossible to do it, you see. I mean, this was not a thing that relaxed me or that made me feel better. That, oh, they will not. I wasn't sure what they were able to do, because in these 2 years we had seen insane things, things you would have never guessed before, and you could not be sure what would happen next. So there was justifiable dread of what was possible. And so it eventually collapsed, and in June, I think, the government announced it was now cancelled. Vaccine mandate was cancelled. So at this point, few people cared about it. And in most of Austria, all this thing was dropped, like the testing and the masks, and only in Vienna they kept it up, which is very, very annoying, because I'm living in Vienna, and still when I go in public transport, I have to look at these faces all day. And I hate this. The mask thing is
still going on. Is it still going on now?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, and you're thinking until next spring, and then they'll. Yeah,
okay. I think they will have to hold out until spring so they can save face, so to speak. You know, I mean, one thing that has changed is that fewer people are obeying it, but still way too few. I mean, nobody's controlling it anymore. And you also have not the self-appointed controllers. You know? I used to have it. I mean, I wasn't wearing masks, and every time, you know. So on some days I was even hoping somebody would, you know, confront me, because I was in a bad mood. And I thought, oh, okay, I'm going to give this guy a real harsh answer. And I had several answers and several ways to deal. I mean, a nice way, a rude way, a fuck-off way.
See, and it was degrading. I remember seeing a clip of some guy on the London Underground. I don't know when, I think it was late 2020. Anyway, whenever it was. And he was wearing the mask, and he was berating someone else for not wearing the mask. And it was just so degrading. You know, I thought, can you not see what they've turned you into, what they've done to you?
Yeah,
it's the sort of thing about the soy boy thing, or bug man, kind of middle aged and frightened and pathetic. And you know, if it were a serious plague, I could understand it. I would be scared, and it would be right to be scared. It would be sane to be scared. But it was clear very early on that this simply wasn't a big deal. That was clear in, I remember talking about it in March 2020 and saying that. Then they made a huge deal out of it. And I thought, well, okay, I must have been wrong. It must be more serious than I realized. But then 2 months after that, I realized, okay, no, it's not serious. That they've done something weird is going on. And then the face of Klaus Schwab appeared on on the TV screens.
That beautiful, charming face, which makes you feel so trusting.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So here, before we get to Ukraine, a question that's very interesting at this point is, could they do COVID again? Or a similar disease? Let's say it's not COVID-2, it's something with a completely different name. Whatever. Do you think that the public could be tricked again in the same way that they were in 2020?
Well, I definitely think so. I mean, there would be a large portion that will not go along. But maybe if there's something more dangerous you create in a lab, I don't know, then more people would go along. Then you may have no other choice than to go along. I don't know. But I still see that some people may have learned. But, you know, when I keep my ears open and I observe what people talk in the public transport, just recently, yesterday, I overheard a conversation, and it was related to some institution where they are still testing. You cannot enter until you get a test, you know, so to show you don't have any virus on. And this woman told the guy that there was a young man and he was really angry because he was refused entry, and he shouted and get very aggressive. And I wanted to ask her, doesn't it bother you more they are still making this than this man who is angry about it, you see? So I can overhear in conversations that there may have been more doubts, but still many people hold on to it and don't question. And there's still irrational things going on. So I'm afraid a thing like this could indeed happen again, you see. And this is something I told you before. I would like to discuss a bit. I mean, it may not be really over. So there may be a replay. There may be other ways to you know, enforce what some people call great reset, whatever you think about it is. And you had my friend Martin Sellner on a few days ago, and you discussed this problem, whether the thing what we call the great replacement is a greater danger, or the great reset is a greater danger, or has political priority. And me and Martin, we had a discussion about this a year ago, and it was released in a book form. Here's the little, it's a small little book, yeah. And it's called Population Replacement Against and Great Reset. And it's a sort of letters, you know, first I write, then he answers, then I answer. And we does discuss this whole thing. And my emphasis is that for me, the Great Reset thing has priority. I mean, I don't have many disagreements with him. It's just a question of where you put the weight, the emphasis. And for me, this is still the case, even a year later, now that it seems to have gone. I mean, it's in a zombie mode now. You can see in some places on this planet, there's still something going on, and you can see the damage, the brain damage it has produced in people. You can see the devastation it has produced. I mean, my country, my city is not the same anymore as before. And many of my friends feel it. And two of my best friends are leaving the country now because they feel like Vienna is dead now after what happened. So things have become different than before.
I agree. And this is why I don't like it when people say COVID is over, as if that's the end of it. It has changed society. It has changed the way we live. It has changed people, the public, and the relationship between the public and the government. And then all the global institutions are much more prominent now. People are more aware of them, and they are more ballsy now than they were. And the powers that be now know that they can, that they have achieved this. They know that this was that this kind of thing is possible. Whereas 3 years ago, they didn't really know whether this would be possible or not. But they've done it now, so they know they can do it. And they will have learned as well. That's the other thing. They will have learned so very much from the process of doing this. So I think they could do it again with sufficient tweaks, upping the ante, more fear porn, the videos from China, whatever. I think if they did that again, they could do it again. And the fact that, you know, like this thing about fool me once, fool me twice, I think they will, even though the public will be skeptical, that will be easily overcome with just a bit of cheaply made fear porn, which will be nothing for them to produce those videos. It'll cost nothing, and the dividends for them will be massive. So I think they could do it again.
That fear porn thing, it has never ceased. It just switched a bit of subject. So I remember in March, all of a sudden, you had to be afraid of Putin. Like, I had these headlines, how Putin is threatening us all, you know, as if he would throw nuclear missiles or invade us. And then the next thing was, you know, about the food shortage and about the gas price rising and all this. And I mean, these were things that were actually happening, but it didn't really help that the media, they're scaring people into it. I mean, I have the impression they are constantly looking for things to scare them about. And now that COVID has receded, I find it that they are trying to make people scared about the flu. I see headlines about how the hospitals have problems. And this is so weird. I mean, when the COVID thing happens, some experienced doctors said, hey, the hospitals in Austria, Vienna, they had these problems for years, infrastructure problems, during the flu period of the year, that they were full and so, and nobody did anything about it. Then COVID came, everybody blamed it on COVID. Now it's going on. COVID has receded dramatically. And you can see it in the data. And still they are trying to make people scared about viruses and about sicknesses and about full hospitals that have the capacities fulfilled. So it goes relentlessly on and on and on. Or climate change, you know. In summer, it was insane. Every time, this is the hottest August since the 16th century, or I don't know, or, you know, something like that. You know, or October is so hot as it has in 1923, the last time. So you were supposed to feel afraid every time it was a bit hotter outside. You were supposed to see this as impending doom.
But now we've got a cold winter. I mean, you know, we had this in Britain as well. It was a very, very hot summer. There was a, you know, really, geez. But now it's a cold winter. I mean, and I know one exception doesn't disprove the whole pattern and all that, but I've never believed in the climate change thing, and I still don't believe it now.
Mm. Well, I don't have a settled opinion on it, but what I can see is how this, whatever is going on, is being used for this fear porn all the time. So, I mean, it's like people have become addicted to it, and it's just downright disgusting. So this is one thing I can see. The amount of propaganda that is being fed to the people is insane. And at the same time, this takes us to the great replacement thing. Other things are being, you know, kept silent. And for example, this year, there was a huge influx of migrants into Austria, almost on 2015 level. And the media were like, look at this direction, look at this direction. You don't see it. It didn't seem to matter. You know, it seemed something normal. You know?
Well, it is normal.
Yeah.
I mean, that has become the new normal.
It has become a sort of new normal, and this is something you don't have to worry about. Yeah? This is something that, you know, don't be afraid. It's okay. At the same time, you know, in Vienna, they had this rise of rapes by migrants. In Germany, there was a very gruesome case where a girl was stabbed by a migrant. There was a very brutal case in France. So these things are happening all the time, and people are told not to worry about that. You know, Martin talked about, you know, the boomer raid, the monarchist boomers that were raided. You know, the media is selling you the idea you have to be scared of those people, you know, all in their 70s, and it's just a bit, you know, crazy. And you have to worry about them.
This is what the media is telling you. It's the same in Britain. There are two soap operas right now that have storylines about the far right.
Right, two of them.
Yeah.
I wish the far right was that powerful. I mean, come on.
Oh. It's just crazy. You know, this is the thing, that this is the most obvious manifestation of this thing that I've talked about, where the media is just a completely fictitious version of reality. It really does not bear much resemblance mm-hmm. to actual reality. And yet that's what's being pumped out. That's what the public are being told is that, okay, it's the far right. You've got to worry about the far right. Don't worry about the massive numbers of people who are coming from the fighting age men who are coming from the third world. We know nothing about them whatsoever. Somehow that isn't something that you need to worry about. But the far right is something. I mean, this is just crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I guess this is a good point now to talk a bit about the disagreements I have with Martin Selner, or let's rather say my personal point of view on all this. I mean, let's go back. I mean, I have been looking at this demographic thing for many years now. I think it was in 2005 when I first read Camp of Saints. This was the bad German translation. I made the good German translation. But still, it was a powerful, very powerful impression I had. And the demographic thing was being discussed in Germany back then, like overaging. They had these population pyramids where you had this aging population, and then you get a younger population moved in that is more fertile, and they have all this. And this was also when the whole Islam thing became more and more present in the media and all. And I must say, I spent a lot of time of my life thinking about that and worrying about that. Yeah. And it certainly was one of the major issues even obsessions on the right wing, at a point where it became almost the single issue. And I understand it, because realizing this made many people move more to the right, because they felt this is not going to end well. This is threatening. I mean, no matter what your political opinions are, I mean, you often find people who are more liberal. They think, I wouldn't want to live in a world where we have so much, you know, Islamic people or all that, you see?
Yeah, an Islamic theocracy isn't going to be good for the local gay scene.
Yeah, something like this, you know.
Yeah.
So there was a, in the 2010s, you know, this all these things peaked and so. And so I did spend quite a lot of time looking at this, and I know how extremely depressing this can be. Yeah? And now the thing is, I don't want to blackpill anybody, but I mean, it's very unlikely that this can be, you know, reverted or redone. Very unlikely. You know, we have to be realistic about it. I mean, I don't know what other ways there are, but for me, you know, the bargaining phase is over. No, the anger phase is almost over. And I did grieve a lot about Europe, and about Europe I knew, but I have to face it. It's not going to return again. And something different is going to happen. I mean, this doesn't mean the end of, let's say, European people or a continuation, but it will be in a different way. And I cannot tell you how. I mean, quite obviously, and many people have talked about it, it's not going to be non-violent. There's going to be violent clashes. It's going to be ugly, very likely, you know. And when people talk about, you know, I mean, Martin, for example, he's an activist mostly, you know. I mean, he's also an intellectual, absolutely. I mean, he's incredibly well-read and well-known about what's going on. But, you know, he's more a man of action, you know. I'm more a man of reflection. And if you think about the technicalities, what would it take, for example, to revert France to how it was like in 1970, 60, or even 1980, or even 1990? You have to consider this. You know, I don't want to go into detail, but it's very unlikely that it's going to happen. And the thing is, when the Martin, he had this one argument, he said resistance against this great reset thing. And I'll go into this in a moment, but how I define it, because there are different definitions and different ideas what this is about. He said that the resistance would have to come from the people. I mean, this is obviously an old globalist idea, you know, that if you dissolve the people, the unity, the identification of a people, and you create all these individuals that don't feel they belong to some collective or bigger thing, then you can more easily control them. Yeah. With COVID, we see a sort of restructuring, you know, a recollectivization on a different level. And we saw a resistance against it in several countries. And what we had in Austria is that this resistance took a decidedly patriotic turn and coloring. So you had the Austrian flags all over. And I could see at the protests, most people, I mean, there were a few migrants, you know, but not really many. You know, it was really a thing from the people of all classes. Yeah,
This is a weird thing. It seems to happen in every country, really. Wherever there is, minorities have their own issues, and you'll see them gathering in crowds and protest to do with their own issues. Like, for example, the Iranian women's rights thing. There are a lot of Muslims in London gathering for protests about that, about something that's happening in Iran. So they've got their own issues, and they're political about and active about those issues. But if it's a general thing in this society, in British society, it's native British people who protest about that. And the minorities are just absent. And it's the same also with things to do with British culture, like the Queen's death. The crowds were almost entirely white. So it's like, if it's something that affects everyone, the minorities are absent. Something that supposedly affects everyone, like the Queen's death or COVID, then the minorities are absent. It's a very strange thing. So sorry to interrupt like that. But,
I mean, I don't think, speaking of Austria, I don't think there was also a lot of non-compliance about minorities because, you know, they have their own little parallel worlds and it's harder for the state to get through there,
It's a weird thing. And I just came up with a previous stream. I was saying this, that in Scotland, when I visited Scotland, it was total compliance. Everyone was wearing masks. Everyone was social distancing and all the rest of it. In London, which is extremely multicultural, there was far more, it was chaotic. You know, they weren't able to enforce rules on a multicultural populace. And so this is an interesting thing because we had this idea that, well, they have multiculturalism because that creates chaos. And then you can control people more easily when they're in chaos. But actually, I don't think it works like that. At least it hasn't yet. Maybe when they bring in just total police state, then they will. It will work. I'm not sure.
Well, the fact that you had this resistance among certain minority groups and the state was unable to get through it proves Martin's point that ethnic cohesion is a force of resistance. And of course, these minority groups are sort of sacred cows. I mean, there are other problems the state cannot enforce among them. But this was one thing you could observe. And I remember that one of the biggest protests in Vienna, I mean, really a crowd of people swept through the whole city. And I'm not a big fan of protests, but these I really enjoyed. This was something special. And I remember that when the crowd passed by this building blocks where migrants lived, you know, Islamic women they would cheer at us. They would cheer at us. And then we would pass through the, Bobo parts of the city where all the liberals, the left-wing liberals live, and they would shout abuse at us, you know, like, oh, well, fucking assholes and so on. So, I mean, this was a very interesting experience. It made me consider a bit, you know, that there may, in this case at least, you know, there may be some something that unites the patriotic or, you know, COVID-critical Austrians with these migrants who are reluctant. And at the same time, we have a sort of civil war against our own people on the left liberal side, for who it was a religion. Yeah? It was a religion for them. Mask wearing was a religion. Getting vaccinated was a sort of virtue signaling. And it's still going on with them. I mean, many of them, they haven't learned of it, you know. And this certainly does increase the alienation you might feel about people from your own kind, you know. I mean, I hardly feel I have much in common with them anymore, I must honestly say, because it became disgusting.
I remember you talked about being on the Vienna, the subway, and you said that the screens were blaring all this stuff about COVID. And you felt that everyone around you was believing it, and that, and you felt very alienated from them.
Yeah. It's an absolutely strange and alienating feeling. And I mean, this kind of alienation you did have before, you know, at the time when the demographic thing was at the center with the migrant thing, you will find a lot of your, let's say, compatriots who either don't care about it or who cheer on it, you know, who are happy to be replaced, you know, or at least they act like it, you see. So there is this gulf, you know, between you and your own people. And I mean, I can tell you a little impression I had recently on the subway. I mean, it doesn't really, I don't really have a point about it, but it's just an impression, you know, to see how I perceive some things. That I'm in the subway. People, there are these mask mandates. They are not controlled anymore, but most people wear them. Whenever I see people who don't wear them, many of them are migrants, you know? And so I entered the subway, it was packed with people. Everybody's wearing these masks, even though nobody really believes in it anymore. They're not controlled. And I see two girls, and one was some Muslim Middle Eastern girl, and the other was a black African girl. And they were not wearing masks, and they were standing close to each other. So I get closer to them. I always do this, and I always side with those who show faces. And during the trip, I see they were talking about the mask thing. I could overhear a little, and I look at their faces, and there was something fascinating about it. I don't know if you can follow, but this Middle Eastern girl was absolute perfection of her type. It was a fine specimen of her racial type. I mean, she had these eyes and this slightly bowed nose, and I mean, I must say she was beautiful. She was a good specimen of her type, and I found this interesting to look at this face. And I don't ever see faces in the subway anymore. I'm happy about any face I see, you know. And the African girl was also like almost a pure racial specimen of her type, you know, very dark skin, very pulpy lips, big eyes, and so on. And so I see this very, there was a contrast between these two as well, you know. So I see them talking. I see a certain, I mean, they saw I wasn't wearing a mask either. So I see this certain, you know, connection, but still also a distance. You know, there was a distance because they are alien types. I mean, I could appreciate that they were quite good specimens of the type. But you
it sounds
see,
like you're so starved of seeing female faces that anything will do. I mean, I don't mean to mock what you're saying.
No, wait for it, because behind these girls, I see two white girls. I mean, okay, this is not a term I think of all the time. So let's say maybe they are Austrian girls, I don't know. But they have their faces covered, you know, and I see these bright, beautiful eyes. I don't know if they are beautiful. I just see these eyes. And one girl, she had this beautiful brown hazelnut hair. The other was blonde. And I thought, yeah, I guess they may be beautiful types as well, but they are hiding their faces. They are hiding behind these faces. They are looking at me like this and all that, you see?
It's so awful because you realize that this is a people who have been warped, a people who are living under oppression, and they don't even realize it. Mm. You know, they've been perverted. So you've got two probably pretty, possibly beautiful Austrian girls, but they're under a spell.
Yes, the word spell is good. I mean, I also, I mean, not just beautiful girls, obviously, but all people I see, I feel they're under spell. People that walk in on the outside, not even in inside rooms or in public transport. Some people are in fresh air, they're still wearing masks, So this impression they are under such strange spell is very, very strong, you see. And of course, this creates a feeling of alienation. So, I mean, why I'm telling this story, I mean, to see the ambivalent feelings you have. I mean, this connection a year ago when things were peaking, this connection was bigger that I felt, I feel bigger connection to anyone who opposes this shit. I would ally with anyone who is opposing this because I felt it was so dangerous, you see. And of course, you can get together for a time if you have a common enemy, but that doesn't change that you may have, issues on other things that separate you. They don't go away, so it's not that easy. And when Martin pointed out this problem that I remember he said this one thing that he would prefer to live in Hungary. Hungary also had joined this COVID game, and I don't think it was that harsh as far as I know. I mean, you have to ask John Morgan or others who live in Hungary. As far as they told me, it wasn't that bad. It was in Austria, for example, and it was transient, you see. And Martin said he would prefer Hungary than Sweden, where they had nothing of that at all. But they do have this replacement leftist policy. I mean, I remember before 2019, when I was talking to Danish people, they told me it's a joke that they say Sweden is a huge insane asylum. They're all crazy about any political correct woke thing. And surprisingly, they would decide not to go along with the COVID thing. Interesting. Okay. So I would say, this made me really think what Martin said here. And I would say, yes, okay. Certainly, in the long run, it's less dangerous to have a phase of COVID restrictions and then you just go along normally and you have a better immigration policy. And in the long run, in Sweden, is doomed if they continue like this, even if they, refuse to have the COVID thing. I see that. Okay. But imagine if it would be. If the COVID things or similar things would never go away, if they would stay forever, then I don't know. It wouldn't be much fun to live in such a society as well. It would be just horrible. I mean, it can
Well,
be
exactly.
ethnically homogenic as much as it wants, but it will be absolutely destructive.
Yes, it won't be Europe as we know it. It won't be Western civilization as we've
No, it
always
would be
known
a
it.
sort of, yeah, it would be a
So,
sort of China, it would be a sort
yeah.
of,
And it won't be the Swedish ethnic group as we've always known it. It won't be the Austrian ethnic group as we've always known it. It won't be the English ethnic group. It will be people who are white. At least for now, but it doesn't really mean much because they've been drained of identity, drained of culture, drained of agency, and they're just globalist drones. And at that point, well, I mean, this is the problem. That this gets us to the problem. What are we fighting for? Now, I mean, it certainly doesn't make me not care about. This stuff about mass immigration and the Great Replacement, I still care very much that Europeans survive and prosper. I don't think anything would make me stop caring about that. But it does. It's a real issue that I feel separated in a fundamental way now from most other white people, most other English people and British people. Because they fell under the spell and that they're now sort of zombies. And I hope that they'll snap out of it. I hope that the loss of luxury will make them wake up and actually be a thinking creature again. But for now, they're zombies. And it's difficult for me to identify with zombies. It's difficult for me to sympathize with them even. It's easy for me to feel contempt for them, but even easier is for me to feel just not contempt, but apathy towards them. Mm-hmm. And I don't like that because, you know, I always had a sort of effortless ethnocentrism, right? I always felt incredibly connected. And I even said once I would love the British people even if they became communist. But that was unfortunate. I think I spoke too soon because now I've seen it. And the trouble with them all becoming communist is that they then hate me for not becoming communist. Or in the case of, you know, COVIDian, whatever. They hate me. They already hate me for, you know, being who I am and whatever. But then there's this additional thing. And it's like at that point you're thinking, what am I doing here? What am I sacrificing everything for to protect this people who just hate me and hate me and hate me for it? It's a real dilemma.
They also seem to like it, you know, pretend to like it, to say what's wrong with it. I mean, we will change into this new specimens of human beings who are, you know, rootless and have no culture and who are guided by technocratic impulses all the time and who cut the ties to their past. And so, I don't know, some people seem to be totally fine with it and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, I mean, I just think they've been brainwashed. I mean, if they were talking about any other animal species, they would find that same idea horrifying.
Yeah,
so there's no reason why they should feel okay about it when it's human beings. In fact, they should feel even more animated about it when it's human beings.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, sure, brainwashing has a lot to do here. They could change their minds if you had different kinds of media, but still, I think this is very disquieting. How many people and how easily they get brainwashed. And it's a fact of life, I guess, of human anthropology, that most people are like that and always have been like that, you see. Something I have to get used to in a way, which is kind of hard for me.
There are some people in the live chat saying... The people have short memories. They will forget COVID so long as it's not sustained or repeated in the media. And then another person says over 20 million British people refused the vaccine. Mm. But then someone points out, were they actual British people or were they immigrants? Because we know that there was, as you said, there was a huge, they had a lot of difficulty persuading ethnic minorities to get the vaccine. It was really the white people who went along with it. As I said, Scotland was just unbelievable. I feel so sorry for anyone who was stuck in Scotland during the whole COVID thing. It must have been even worse than it was down in London.
Yeah. I mean, this takes me to this point where I would like to talk a bit what I mean by the Great Reset thing. You see, I mean, there are different, let's say, stories about it going on. I mean, there's a program that calls itself the Great Reset by the World Economic Forum. And there was even this book by Klaus Schwab, and they have several videos on. And so it's not entirely clear what they're up to, but there are all these promises that you would save the world from climate change and from hunger and from disease and all that. And you know, this notion that the way Western civilization has developed cannot go on anymore. There has to be something done about it. And this is something I actually would agree, you see. I mean, not just on the immigration policies and all that, but also other things. I do worry about economical and environmental things. I think these are real issues, absolutely real issues. And World Economic Forum, Illuminati are addressing this and they promise they have a sort of solution. And when COVID happened, they were very eager to announce this as the big chance to have the Great Reset, like a start anew. Like if your computer is stuck, then you just switch it off and reboot it, and then you make things better. You remember the phrases that went around when every politician would
we're going to build back better. This is a chance to rebalance our economy. Rebuild, I remember it. Yeah.
So you have this song all over again. But this question is what they are really up to, and certainly there is a lot of doubt that there are good intentions there. There's a lot of elite resentment and a lot of enmity towards elites, also based on their previous policies and so. And this is certainly completely justified. And this is when all the different, let's say, conspiracy theories popped up. And I'm not even using this in a negative term, because I, for my part, I do believe in conspiracies. I don't believe in every conspiracy theory, but obviously some sort of coordination was going on here, and otherwise this could not happen as it happened.
They openly said that. I mean, they're not even hiding that, so it's very clear. Especially with Klaus Schwab being as autistic as he is, he just says these things.
Or Bill Gates. Bill Gates is even more autistic and is saying these things as well. So, yeah. I mean, there you have it. In some ways, you could say, some people suggest that this might just have been some sort of a test experiment, for future things. And as you said, if I was part of the elites, I would have closely watched what happened, what things did work, what things did not work. And I get it that some people argue, look, the policies were failures. I mean, the lockdowns were failures. They didn't do what they wanted to do. They did a lot of harm. The vaccines were failures and all that. And they have to cover their failures up. But on the other hand, I can see that, they just go along as if nothing happened. I mean, the people who sold the vaccines, they got filthy rich. They got filthy rich. You know, they didn't introduce international COVID passports by now, but they still want to. There was this globalist meeting, the G20 meeting recently, and they had a resolution which was signed also by Russia, by the way, which said in the future, we, these countries in the G20, we will work together to fight pandemics, to introduce COVID passports, and to go on with all the things they have done as if nothing had happened. No, it's in the document. You can read it. So,
This is the thing. These people are proceeding based on a lie. They're the starting point for this new regime. And I'm like, I know it goes back further than 2020. I know that this regime has existed for a long time, but the inauguration of it was COVID. And that was a big lie. So that immediately tells you this is a regime that's completely okay with lying to the public. It's completely okay with massive deceit. So that doesn't inspire confidence. That doesn't make me think, okay, this is going to be a benign regime. This is going to be a regime that responds to it. And then, of course, it doesn't respond to its own failures. The vaccine. I'm assuming that the vaccine isn't supposed to be killing people and that is a failure on their part. But what do they do with that failure? They just cover it up. They just deny it. They just don't talk about it. So, again, whether it's deliberate or a screw-up, the vaccine, the lockdowns, all of that, whether it's deliberate or part of design or not, it's bad. And the fact that they're not admitting it and saying, okay, we fucked up, or we tricked you all, that tells you immediately, okay, this is not a straightforward thing. This is not a regime that thrives on truth or really has any interest in truth.
So you can assume that in any other issue, people lie to you as well.
Exactly.
And by now, there are people who are aware that the vaccines failed, that they caused a lot of damage, but we still don't have an exact investigation what kind of damage the vaccines caused. There are these reports about more people dying than usual. There are these reports about, sudden death and all. There are reports about the cardiac problems caused. And they are disputed again. So it's a bit like Schrödinger's vaccine side effects. they are there, but they are really not there. I mean, there's no official investigation, no official recognition of what's happened. This makes it so annoying. And some of the stuff you find, I mean, recently there was this documentary released on the internet about sudden death. I forgot what it was called, but there was a lot of bullshit in it, seriously. I mean, it was shocking. So, I mean, there's a lot of interesting good things in it, but a lot of bullshit as well. So,
Or do you mean that really the documentary was... You mean was wrong? Right.
Okay. Yeah, this documentary about sudden death things, you know, I just forgot the exact title, but it became viral. It was very successful. And so it's kind of frustrating because it seems like you never really seem to get to the actual truth. And the regime, let's say, has now, you know, improved its ability to throw fog, you know, create brain fog to distort reality. This makes it so difficult. And this was my point about priority of great reset against population replacement, that I would define the great reset as the least common thing. It is the technocratic control, whatever the purpose is. I mean, I know there are people who say in the long run, it's supposed to have a population reduction, you know, by, I don't know, killing people through vaccines or so. I have no idea about that. And I feel many of these claims seem to be exaggerated. You know? But the one thing that is very clear, that this all has to do with a stronger technocratic control of people, of their minds, of the individuals, of their way of living. This is what they're up to, absolutely. And they say it's for our own good. You know, we will be controlled, that we do not harm the climate by our consumption, by our breathing, by our driving cars and so on. And this is the way it's going. And if this is implanted, then no opposition against anything whatsoever will be possible, let alone, I mean, the great replacement thing was difficult long before COVID happened. And it was a thing that was not very popular, you see? I mean, because it was really like a mine, a bomb that would explode if you approach it, you know? It was associated with many ugly things. It was quite dangerous. There was huge state repression about it. When the anti-COVID protests happened, I must say I felt a certain relief, because all of a sudden I was engaging myself for a thing that had a broader base, you know, a broader consensus, because you would never get so many people on the street against population replacement as happened against COVID mandates. You know, I mean, it would be good if there would be such a resistance against it. The government would have to think twice about letting immigrants in. And I felt a sort of relief. I felt like, ooh, I was finally a bit out of this pigeonhole, you know, where great replacement things are associated with terrorism and with ugly things and ethnic cleansing and whatever, you see what I mean? So for me personally, I'll be honest here, you know, it was a bit like stepping a step back from the abyss and not gazing into it too much. Certainly, I'm going to quote the famous Nietzsche quote, it's overdone. You know, you gaze into the abyss long enough, abyss gazes back into you. I mean, I have felt this, yeah? Because it's very tiresome and very depressing to gaze into this abyss of ethnic replacement and how it's going on. It can drive you crazy, absolutely crazy, you see?
Oh, God, yes. Mm. Yeah, it drains you. It takes a lot out of you, and it costs you as well. You know, socially, financially, everything. So I do understand. For me, it was more that this is a new thing. This is something new to get my teeth into. It's something interesting, and it was interesting, and it was real as well. And it wasn't like this was some indulgence. It was very, very real, and so I. I wouldn't say I'm not going to say that I enjoyed it, but I appreciated the opportunity to understand something new, to come to grapple with it and come to understand. And I still haven't succeeded. I still don't fully understand it. Like, I don't understand how the economy is going to work, for example. Mm. I don't understand what are most people going to do? Are they just going to be in the pod jerking off? I mean, I've no idea. So I don't fully understand this yet. But nonetheless, it is it is intellectually fascinating, and I'm more of an intellectual than anything. Well, than an activist, for example. So
yeah, let me. No,
yeah,
I agree totally. There was also something personally exciting about it. See, I mean, first of all, something different. You know, I had been talking about the same thing every goddamn fucking day, and you realize there's nothing you can do about, like, throwing pebbles against Niagara Falls. Huh? Now something new was happening, and it was not apparent for anyone to understand what's going on here. You had to think about new things. I mean, I had no interest whatsoever to think about how do viruses work or vaccines, you know, and or to think about this whole globalist power structure. I mean, it had been an issue before. If you had been reading Huntington 20 years ago, he talked about the Davos man and, you know, the ruthless cosmopolitan elites who serve, you know, the dead souls, he called them, who serve just their companies and their power. And so, I mean, so of course you thought or cared about it, but now this entered into a new stage and you were forced to figure out what's going on. Also because the threat was far more immediate than anything I encountered before. I mean, for me personally, Austria in many ways is luckier than other countries as far as the great replacement goes. So I didn't perceive it here as a very immediate threat. No, but now the government was, you know, breathing into my neck and trying to brainwash me into doing all sorts of things, you know, and my friends and my family. It was a much more immediate threat than anything I had encountered before. And in order to understand it, you had to figure out what's going on here. And this certainly was also something fascinating. It was a fascinating intellectual fight.
Oh, it absolutely was. It was fascinating. And because it's not how I would have expected it. I wouldn't have expected. And indeed, I always thought, and I've said this before, I always thought that people who predicted a totalitarian government were reaching back to 1984. We're reaching back to that sort of cliche. Because it was the last thing we had in terms of predicting the future. The last big dystopian vision was 1984. So I thought people were just sort of reaching to that because there was nothing else. And it was like a default fear that they were going for. But that they were actually wrong and that there wasn't going to be totalitarianism. That's what I used to believe. And it seems very naive now.
Yeah. I mean, this was really, like going through sometimes you wouldn't believe what's going on. You would really feel like you're in some movie or in some dystopian novel or so. And this was absolutely unprecedented, new. And,
Go on.
I do feel a relief at this moment now that it has receded, you see? And, but of course not entirely. I mean, it could come back any time. So I'm prepared. I'm aware, you know, and I'm still figuring out what actually happened because, I mean, if you go into what happened, it's very complex. There are many theories going on about it. And I haven't seen yet an entire, narrative that really fits everything. Probably you will never have that. Because any historical process would be that complex that not everything fits. But I mean, I'm not done figuring out what happened. There are still many things to solve, many things to consider, to understand what may await us in the future. So the intellectual investigation is not over yet. And you have to put an effort to understand in order to understand what may be coming up against you.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I don't exactly, and I don't feel that this is over, and I don't feel that the analysis of it is complete either. So it goes on. Somebody said earlier when you were talking about the abyss, and someone said, if you really want to look into the abyss, read some Yuval Noah Harari. And I know that you have read one of his books, haven't you?
Not just one, yes. I have read three of them. Not in entirely. I hadn't read entirely his most successful book called A Brief History of Mankind or so. Then he had the sequel called Homo Deus, which is the idea of what the future will bring with transhumanism and so. And then he has lectures for the 21st century. I agree. You look into the abyss. I have a bit of a nuanced view on Harari. No, I don't consider him to be the total villain he's portrayed to be. I know we can go into that a bit, you know, not that I really feel about like it, but you could see that, he has been appointed by World Economic Forum as the philosopher they want. He had a huge boost of popularity, and he gets supported by all kinds of suspicious people like, you know, Zuckerberg and Barack Obama and Bill Gates. They all, you know, cheered his book, so it became a bestseller. I mean, I think the first version of The Brief History of Mankind was written 10 years ago, and it didn't enjoy so much success until it got some boost by the usual suspects. Yeah, and I think it's an interesting read, you know. It's not something really original. It's just the old progress story of this animal that is becoming conscious, becomes so-called human, and then conquers the world, and in the long run just liberates itself from nature. This is what it's all about. This is like a whole progress success story of this creature, which he calls sapiens, which is rising above nature on and on and on. And he has become increasingly more enthusiastic about all kinds of things you can do in the future with the body, with the brain. He believes that in 100 years, you will not have sapiens anymore. You will have a push in evolution, which is done by this sapiens itself, which is a new thing. So he believes, certainly in evolution, but now the next step will be done by technology, by, you know, human beings' own minds. And you're never really sure when he says the usual phrases, our, we, you know, who is we here? You know, certainly all these improvements or so-called improvements of the human being, they will not apply to 7 billion people. So certainly it will be only the elite he's the philosopher for that will profit for it. And all these things he's describing that will be possible in the future, many of them are just terrifying ways to control people, you know, to destroy everything that is worthwhile or human. And you don't need to have much imagination to see how dangerous all this is, you know. And he often admits it, you know. I mean, sometimes you don't know, is he just analyzing something? Is he stating something in a matter-of-fact way? Or is he finding this actually a good thing? You're never sure about that with him. And so I also found that he has a lot of concerns that, I do share. I mean, he says that, the copy of the book I have on the cover, you see a globe of a planet, and it's populated with human beings, you know. It's just full with the human beings are like little ants on this globe. And occasionally you see some building architecture, something that human beings have created, you know, rising out of this flood of little human beings, you see. And it's a kind of strange and disgusting cover on the German version. And he says, yes, of course, technological progress and overpopulation has turned the world, he says, something like a mixture of a supermarket and a garbage dump. Yes. And I agree with that, of course, you know. I mean, I can see it happening, you know. He considers this a problem. He's also very concerned about animal cruelty. He has actually in his book photos of chicken being shredded. Now, the male chicken, you don't need them for, this chicken breed thing, this mass. So you just kill them and dump them. And this is horrible things happening. And I agree, this is a horrible things. And they have to do with mass society. So you get a lot of things he sees about progress and about technological advancement that have created problems, as opposed for human beings, for animals, for the environment. I agree about that. But his belief is that this can be solved by the same thing that produced it. you see. So you just need to have renewable energies. If you have an energy crisis, you have to, I don't know, ways to, if meat is cruel and inhuman, you produce artificial meat and so. So there are all these kind of ideas how you can solve these problems by technology. So with the same poison that created it. And this is when it gets a bit suspicious, you know, especially when he becomes too enthusiastic about this idea that there used to be an idea of God and of higher being and of ethics. And he's a complete atheist. He's even, I would even say in a certain way, he's a nihilist, you know. He believes in nothing else but the human mind. The human mind will be now God and will replace everything. And it was very telling to see him announce a children's book version of his bestseller.
How delightful.
Yeah, there's a comic book version now, a graphic novel, and there's a children's book version. And he announces it like this. He says, you know, you can raise your kids, either you put on them the whole weight of history, the garbage of your religion, of your tradition, of your culture, and they carry on. Or you can educate your children, you know, without all these things, you know, because you can educate them to be free, to be liberal, liberated of all this. You know? This is his ideology, like a total liberation of anything from the past you might carry with you from the past. And this is certainly very different of a concern that, let's say, conservatives or right-wingers have. We are more concerned about, I mean, we don't need to drag on everything from history. Certainly, you have to let things drop, you know, or they become useless at one point, you know. But you also think it's dangerous to reach a blank point, you know, where human beings are just blank canvases where you can write your technological codes onto and so. And this is what Harari believes, and this is what makes it quite scary what he says. Yeah, so, well, the one quote by him, I mean, of course, he likes to provoke to get attention, but this one quote by his, which I found particularly unpleasant, was when he said, "We used to believe that we are mysterious souls. Now we know that we are hackable animals." It's very brutal, you know. And
yeah, okay, it's an ugly thing. And I remember there was another quote where he said something about this idea of people having souls is over, it's gone.
Yeah.
People are just combinations of algorithms.
Horrible. You know, I mean,
it just sounds like the stereotypical megalomaniac who's overreaching, massively overreaching, and there's going to be disastrous consequences.
Everybody, you and me, we are codes to be cracked, you know, and we can be hacked and we can manipulate it. And this makes his, I mean, I guess he is honest when he is concerned about cruelty against animals and all that. But on the other hand, I mean, he sees animals as well as biocomputers. Human beings are biological computers. Animals are just biological computers as well, with codes you can write and rewrite and all that. And so I find it hard to take it too serious, his concern about animals, because if he thinks animals are just, you know, biomaterial you can manipulate. I mean, he has a chapter about did you hear about the glowing rabbits? It was 20 years. It has been already about 20 years ago that there was some genetic manipulation of a rabbit. And I think it got inserted some genes by some underwater fish or so who glows in the dark. So the rabbits would glow in the dark, you see? And no, I can't help myself. I cannot find this good, you know? I mean, this thing, you have the creatures, the animals, they're just like things you can build. Be God yourself. There's something perverse, something, you know.
You know, it's funny. I've just been reminded of there was a song, Supernature, back in the late disco, like the late 70s. Erasure did a cover version of it, but it's talking about this, about man, you know, messing around with nature and creating all these monsters, and then they destroy the world. And then they're left alone with the world and they have to rebuild it. And it's very... What was it?
Oh, I don't know. I remember in Blade Runner.
Cerrone, it was called, yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh. You have to send me to.
I will, and I'll put it in the live chat. Just weird. It just seems to marry up with what Yuval Noah Harari is saying. Weirdly enough. Anyway,
to put this work more into context, as I say, I mean, it's an old story, this progress story, this success story of human being, but it's especially wrapped to appeal to these tech people, to the Silicon Valley kinds of people. When they read this book, they feel very important, no? Because they feel like they are the ones who are making a big evolutionary change, and they are the people that matter and all that. And this is also why it got such a promotion by certain kinds of people, because it flatters them. They feel just great about it. And another aspect which I should mention is that Harari, he has a very a kind of surprising, rather positive reassessment of European colonialism. You know, he says, okay, there are bad sides to it, but he also says that colonialism helped to spread progress and technology and all. And he does believe that also a world government is necessary, that is run by elites from all kinds of countries that form a supranational elite. And this empire is supposed to do the same thing, spread the gospel of transhumanism and technology, and in this way sort of, you know, reform the world and cure all the problems that there are. This is what he believes, and it's insane.
It's interesting to hear it said shamelessly and openly, straightforwardly. I think I really should read his books, because it does sound fascinating but disturbing but necessary to know about this stuff. I'm not sure if there is anything else to say about that, but because I'm aware of the time, we've got 25 minutes left, and I don't want to keep him waiting too long. The other thing that I wanted to ask you about was the Ukraine war and Nord Stream, and then the resulting energy shortages. Is there anything that you would say? I mean, I know you didn't want to talk about Ukraine at great length. I'm not asking you to, but this seems to be a new phase. I mean, obviously, it followed on directly from COVID. COVID was fairly quickly ended as a world event in February, January, February. And then we were straight on to Ukraine. And it seems like the return of an older way of... Because COVID was very new, very confusing, novel. But Ukraine, the Ukraine war seems like the return of something old. What would you say about that?
All right, well, I don't know where to get started. You mentioned Nord Stream. I do believe almost certainly that this was done by Americans or by American allies to cut off any connection there may have been between Russia and Germany, which was always their geopolitical aim to make this not happen, this connection, this transcontinental connections. And I think it's pretty obvious. And of course, the German government was keeping silent and cucking about it, and it's almost already forgotten. I mean, Americans had opposed this project from day one. So, and I don't see Russia benefit from it at all, you see. And
of course, and it was rather strange to hear people claiming that it could have been, it might have been Russia. It probably was Russia. Rather strange. Yeah. It never made sense to me. It was clearly America or its allies doing it for America.
I mean, you would have to think about several 3D chess moves to really blame it on Russia, as well as some other things. So you see, by now Putin has become the great villain in the media, and Russia is the great villain. And also in Austria, we have the Ukrainian, pro-Ukrainian propaganda all over. And I mean, I see also that my view of Russia had been also more positive before the war, I must say, you see. Certainly my point of view is the Mersheimer point of view. I mean, I believe this is a war that could have been avoided and has been largely pushed forwards by NATO and by Western aggression. And Russia is just doing what it always had done. You know, I mean, no matter what kind of regime is there in Russia, the geopolitical aims of Russia are always the same. And Ukraine is just a key point here. And the way I see it, yes, I mean, it's not very original. What I'm saying is I do see it as a proxy war here. And I just feel it's absolutely horrible and depressing. And Ukrainian people are just being slaughtered and sent into into their death for interests they are not really theirs. And I consider certainly Zelensky is obviously a total fake. This is a disgusting show that is being put on. I mean, this guy's an actor, for God's Christ's sake. He has been hired to do an actor's part, and I see he's being sold here as the great hero and the great leader.
Strange how they've manufactured a sort of brand for him. They've turned him into a brand. So there's this wee pudgy, this short, plump guy, and he's always wearing the green and the khakis. You never see him wearing anything else. And then you get these different photo shoots of him, and he's always, I suspected that there'd been PR firms involved in this, image consultancies and all that.
Yeah.
Someone said that was the case. That they've created him as a figure in a way that I've never seen this before. Mm-hmm. I guess that the machinery for handling public perception and managing public opinion is now so advanced that they can, this is sort of taken for granted that, well, we'll obviously manufacture a brand for the guy who's on our side, the guy who we are supporting. We'll turn him into a sort of meme. And yeah. that's what they've done. But of course, the truth about him is always lurking in the background, that all these ridiculous videos from his past when he's dancing and semi-naked and weird and gay. I mean, it's all so bizarre. But it does interest me how they've manufactured this guy. And people fall for it. And again, the NPC thing comes in again. The people just go along with it. Okay, he's the good guy. Putin is the maniac madman.
Yeah, I mean, the propaganda has become so kitsch, in other words, or campy, corny. I mean, you have this heroic, you know, like Zelensky, looking into the distance, and this kind of corny graphics, and it's just mind blowing how silly it is, and you're supposed to buy it.
Yeah, and he's always asking for help. He's always asking for more money. He's always asking for more sanctions. He's always asking for more weaponry, constantly. And again, it doesn't seem real. It doesn't seem quite natural. It seems like he's been told to do this. It's like a program's running. Just keep doing this. Keep doing this. Keep doing this. And again, I think that this is intended to have an effect on the global or the Western public. This is this figure who says these things to you, who asks for your help or your politician's help, and you are to go along with that. You are to approve of that. And then he also brings in stuff like climate change, which is just incredible. I mean, there's so much that he's done, like banning the opposition parties, banning the Russian Orthodox Church.
Yeah.
It's... and censorship of many kinds, and the LGBT stuff. I think there was something about, I think it was gay marriage in Ukraine during a war, and it talking about climate change as well. I mean, it's just incredible. Yeah. How this guy is just not, as you would expect, a leader in the middle of a war to be or to behave.
Yeah, I mean, he was cast in a TV show as a comedy show as the president of Ukraine. You know the story, which is also very strange. I mean, it's even weirder than Trump being a TV personality. I mean, Ukraine.
They never wanted him to become president, but they did clearly have it in mind that Zelensky might one day be president.
Yeah, I mean, there has been American PR agencies, they are involved in Ukraine at least since 2004, when they had a sort of the Orange Revolution was called. It was a sort of predecessor to the Euromaidan. And they had their fingers in the pie all over to give them advice to do public relations and all that. So I think it's very clear that Zelensky, he gets his lines fed and all, and the climate change thing is a thing that appeals to Westerners. They like it and all.
Exactly. Make us feel more guilty. Make us feel more selfish and indulgent so that we can hate ourselves more. Really, I say it with a smile, but it's so unhealthy.
Okay, so we are running to our end here. So let me tell you a bit of a story here. I did research. It's related to all that. And, you see, we don't have time to go into that. I mean,
We've got 20 minutes. Don't worry about it.
Okay, so, I mean, obviously, I don't see Putin as the good guy as well. I mean, I see this in a very dry manner, and Putin is not the savior, like many in the West believe. I mean, Russia is reaching out to Western dissidents, and they do have points. I mean, when Putin and Russia, when they put out some statements, Putin had a speech a few months ago. I mean, some parts were really a brilliant critique of American, Western, British, so Anglo-imperialism, which is globalism. But he also was pushing the guilt buttons when he talks about slavery and colonialism and racism and all that. So there's a lot of, Soviet communist ideology still in there. So the Russians are doing the same thing. They are pushing these guilt buttons. So everybody tries to reach their goals here. And I get lost a bit. The thing is, I told you, I have been studying recently some Russian and Ukrainian propaganda films. And on Secession, my home page where I'm writing for, I wrote a lengthy series where I'm analyzing these movies. I must say it was really atrocious to watch them. It's amazing how similar propaganda movies are. They are mirroring each other in a way. In one movie, you have just the opposite of the other. The bad guys and the good guys, it's just a pattern of propaganda. And you see the truth is, I mean, it's a cliche to say the truth is in the middle, because it's not always in the middle, but you can see that both sides do have points. And so here's for example, a film that is being pushed in the West, not much, but a bit. It's a film that's called White Raven. And it's a film about a Ukrainian pacifist who turned into a professional sniper. So, and it's based on a true story. And you know about the things, the movies that are based on true stories, like Ilsa Schiwolf of the SS is based on a true story, or Zhu Zeus is based on a true story. So, I mean, Texas Chainsaw Massacre is based on a true story. So this really doesn't mean anything, but it signals to the viewer, you have to take this more serious, what you see here, for whatever reasons. Yeah? And so it's a technically well-made, glossy war movie. And I did research a bit about the character behind it, and I found some interesting discrepancies between what is shown on the screen and what actually happens. You see, so in the movie, he's this guy, he's environmentalist, very radical, and he lives with his wife in a sort of hobbit house in the earth, away from civilization, and he rides to his working place every day with a bicycle. And he has this hippie look with long hair, a Jesus beard, and his wife as well. They are made up to look a bit like shamans, and they're living this happy, cozy, lovely hippie life. Yeah? And all of a sudden, the Russians turn evil. It's set in eastern Ukraine, I have to say. So it's in Donetsk region. So, and in 2014, the film is set in 2014, all of a sudden the Russians turn evil for no reasons at all. Huh? Really nasty and are being mean to them. And then you see Russian soldiers invading from Russia, and they are you know, pretending they are separatists. They're wearing these St. George ribbons. And then they, you know, they just rape and kill his pregnant wife and burn down his house. And then he's so pissed. He has only one thought in his head. I have to, you know, fight the invaders. And he becomes a professional, very cool sniper. And the rest of the movie, you just see him, how he, you know, professionally kills Russians. And
when the shaman began to hate, sort of thing.
Yeah, genau, when the shaman began to hate. It was interesting to see, because I didn't see this in Western movies anymore. It's really a celebration of killing your enemy. It's really celebrated, you see. And at the same time, it is emphasized that he's a good man, you know. He always keeps a little wooden figure of an angel his wife has carved. And this is a sign he's fighting the good thing. And even though he's killing all those Russians, doing for the good cause, and he has reasons for it. I mean, okay, I watched also Russian propaganda movies. And in these movies, it's the opposite. You have these Eastern Ukrainian separatists, and they are getting attacked by, I don't know, Azov regime and Ukrainian army for no reason at all. And they are being mean and nasty to them. And they are the good heroes defending their homeland. So in one movie, the invaders are the Russians. In the other movie, the invaders are the Ukrainian army and evil Nazis from Azov battalion listening to black metal music and so on. So you have these corresponding patterns. But back to this White Raven movie. So I did some research about that guy, whose name is Nikola Voronin, you see? And I found out that one part of the story is true. He was really a sort of hippie pacifist, and he changed his mind in 2014. But the thing with his wife never happened. I didn't find any interview. I saw old articles about him. No article mentioned that his wife was raped and killed. It didn't happen. You see, and obviously it's in the movie to make you feel very angry about the Russians because they're doing these mean things. And I'm not saying mean things don't happen in the war, but I believe they happen on both sides. The problem is you show it in a movie for a purpose, you see? And so it turns out that he became really a hardcore nationalist. He says when he saw that, you know, Russian soldiers came across the border and they supported the separatists and ugly things were going on, and he became very fanatical. And I saw an interview when he was in Canada, and there are lots of exiled Ukrainians in Canada, and they are all big fans of Stepan Bandera, if you're aware of it. So he's considered a hardcore fascist nationalist, and he's an idol for exiled Ukrainians, mostly, many of them. So he appears on Stepan Bandera TV, and he's talks about how he's fighting the Russians. And then the last thing I found about him was in 2019, and it was prior to the election of Zelensky. And now things get interesting. He went into a hunger strike to force Zelensky to apologize for things he said about the Euromaidan people, the Orthodox Church in Ukraine, these people they call the Heavenly Hundred. These are those that were killed by snipers, you know, on this one day when, and the snipers had also some dubious origin. And so apparently Zelensky, he said some disrespectful things about things that are very dear to Ukrainian patriots. And this guy, Mykola Voronin, he was so offended by it that he went into a hunger strike to force. And Zelensky at this point was just a candidate. It was 1 month. The article I found was 1 month before the election, before he became president. And in this interview, Voronin says that he believes that Zelensky basically is a fake. He's astroturfed. He's made to brainwash the Ukrainians, appeared in this TV show. And if he gets elected, nothing good will come for Ukraine of that. Very harsh words about him.
And I'm guessing that all of that was missed out of the film.
It's not in the film. The film was started in 2019. They shot it in 2019 before the Russian invasion of this year. It was released this year. Yeah. In the film, you have a very glossy figure, far less nationalist than the real guy. And also after I did not, it was hard to find anything because then obviously I don't speak Ukrainian or Russian and it was hard to find sources, but I didn't find any source what happened to him afterwards. What his opinion is now of Zelensky, what he's doing now, if he's still alive, I couldn't find anything. You know, I could find a few Instagram photos, but they were not saying anything. So I wonder what was going on here, you see? So I see some fascinating thing here. You have the glossy propaganda movie and you have the real figure. And you see this figure in 2019 pointed out that something was very, very wrong about Zelensky. Interesting, no? And
it certainly is. And that presumably was around the time that they were making this film.
So yes. I don't know. I'm not sure when shooting started. Yeah. But it was released now this year. And I have a Russian correspondent. He's not a friend, but a guy I know. He's living in near the border, the Ukraine-Russian border. And he's writing me lots of things from Russian point of view. He says they had tens of thousands of refugees coming from eastern Ukraine. And he says that, yes, it's true. The eastern Ukrainian Russians, they were being shelled. Thousands of civilians killed by the Ukrainian army and atrocities committed. I believe this is true. He says he talked to refugees. They told him this. And he thinks that this film was being made to appeal rather to Western audiences than to Ukrainian audiences. I can't say, but one thing, why would they pick a guy who's an environmentalist? Because this is a cool thing in the West. You know, this is like you said, when Zelensky mentions the climate change shit and so,
I mean, I guess that could get us on to talking about Extinction Rebellion and so on, but that would be a huge tangent. But yeah, it's interesting. Do you think to some extent it was made for Western audiences? Or
I can't tell. It's hard to tell for me. You know? I don't have enough context. I mean, I saw some films that were obviously made just for Russian audiences, and they were atrocious, you know. Oh, it was so bad. It was so painful to watch it. But it gives you a good idea what kind of story is sold in Russia. It's very different than the stories sold here. And both stories have truth in it, but, you know, they are distorted to create some bigger picture. And now I went into a little detail of a thing I had researched, but I think it's important to keep this always in mind, you know. I mean, this is a conflict. We are supposed to be partitions in that conflict. I mean, I, for my part, yes, I want NATO to crash against the wall. No, and I think the best solution would be a separation of eastern Ukraine and leave Crimea to Russia. I see no other way. I don't see why all these people have to die and die and die for a war they cannot win. You see, I mean, and you can think of Putin or Russia as assholes as much as you like, but this is not how wars are being ended. With total defeat, in the end, you have to find a compromise. And I thought it was a very good lesson to watch these very partition movies from both sides to get an idea of these different mindsets. It's very easy to get dragged into the mindset. And I see on the right, also, I think the Anglophone right, there's this sort of another split. You know, first, they were not... you know, they had issues about COVID. Now they have issues about, are you siding with Ukraine or with Putin and so on. And it's also not very, let's say.
No, well, the Anglophone right continually fights with itself and beats itself up and all these ructions and schisms. It's happened continuously all the time that I've been involved in it. Definitely, I mean, I can't even remember what people were arguing about in 2016 or 17, but I know they were. And it was pretty big stuff. But certainly COVID was a huge one. And now this, Ukraine is a huge one. I mean, let's get to the issue of Nord Stream, because, and don't worry, I've spoken to the next guest. He's prepared to wait 10 or 15 minutes. It's fine. The issue of Nord Stream is very interesting for me. And I did a rant at the time about it, where I was saying, you know, this is obviously America, and America has screwed over Germany. It's one of its allies, and it screwed over one of its allies in a huge way. Apparently, Germany might have to deindustrialize. I don't know what that exactly would entail. But what's your perspective on Nord Stream and the repercussions of losing Nord Stream?
Well, all right. I mean, if you think the Americans have done it, and I think it's very likely, it's a strange, embarrassing, open secret how the German government is cocking to it and keeping very, very silent, you see. You remember when it came out, there was this clip of Biden appearing from the beginning of the year when he says, you know, we have ways to make this stop. You see,
yeah.
And he's being asked by, I don't know, a German reporter, so how are you going to do this? And he says, believe me, we have ways. And so this was like a threat. It's like a mafia threat almost. You see? And I think the German government knows about it and they cannot do anything about it. They have been controlled by USA for a very long time, for decades. I mean, not entirely. Sometimes I remember there was Chancellor Schröder 20 years ago. He would refuse to participate in the Iraq war. He would be very friendly with Russia. And I mean, even Merkel thought it was in the national interest of Germany to align with Russia and get the Nord Stream pipeline. You see? So, I mean, the German elites, they were not entirely oblivious about German national interest. It's not true. I mean, they had some things going on.
That is surprising. That's very surprising about Merkel. Mm. That's really interesting, actually.
Merkel was supporting the pipeline, even against American pressure, and they thought it would be a good thing. And I guess it is. It is. And for German national interest, this is certainly bad, and it creates a bad situation for Germany. Now, Germany has to buy some fracking gas from America or, I don't know, Russian gas with a, you know, from third or fourth countries until they get it. And this is certainly a disaster. And by now, I'm not sure where it's going to lead to. When it happens, some predicted this winter is going to be a winter full of protests. People will be very angry. People will not be able to pay their bills. People will freeze, blah, blah, blah. And some expected there would be protests on the scale of the vaccine, anti-vaccine protests, but it didn't happen so far. There were protests, but not on that scale. And people are still not suffering that badly. I mean, I can say it here in Austria, we are also not suffering that badly. I mean, things have gotten more expensive and all, but there's not this really pressure here, not the same pressure as it had last year. And
Well, that's good. I mean, I'm very relieved to hear that because it seemed like this could be dreadful. I mean, one thing I did hear was that they'd stockpiled energy, gas and so on. So actually, this winter will be okay, but next winter will be...
Next winter, the winter after that and so on.
Yeah.
No idea where this would lead to. And I mean, Martin Selner would say this is a good thing. When people have economic pressure, then change can come. It's the time of the revolutionary. But I don't think the identitarian movement will be in charge of it. I mean, you also discussed the issue that whether this is on purpose. No? There's like the same thing with the lockdowns. There's some economic wrecking on purpose. The first cough in almost 2 hours, so it's not that bad. And I can't give you an answer to that. I simply don't know. It sometimes seems like it. It seems like the lockdowns were made on purpose to crush the economy, and the decisions German governments and other governments made right now also seem like it. I mean, even in March, when the sanctions against Russia became, and I don't know little about economics, but even me, who's an economic idiot, could tell you this sanction will not hurt Russia. They will hurt us. They will hurt our people. And of course, it happened that way. And if I know it, how is it possible that Boris Johnson or Scholz or Macron, they didn't know it? Unthinkable.
And of course,
Macron,
and Macron did recently say I think he said the age of abundance is over, or the age of luxury is over. I can't remember the exact phrasing, but
look, this line is now repeated just like the Build Back Better line. I have heard it from Austrian politicians. I read it by German politicians. This is the line that is now getting through the channels from wherever source it comes. And this seems to be some plan or idea. And I mean, personally, under circumstances, I would agree and say Western world does live in a perverse abundance, which I dislike and which is corrupting people. And so I'm just not thinking that the elites are having a good intention of doing this.
Yeah. You see, you're saying that we have had too much abundance and it has corrupted us, but the elites don't have good intentions here. And I agree with you. I think those two things are both true.
And maybe you know, the elites know things that we don't know about it, that there already have to be taken some measures against upcoming energy problems, like when they say peak oil is being reached or so. But by now, I see that what they're doing is not really necessary. I mean, there's not a shortage of gas from Russia. They just don't want Russia to deliver gas, you see. And when they are saying, no, we will run out of gas anyway in a few decades, so right now we have to deindustrialize and now we have to switch to alternative energies, all this rings a bit false to me. I mean, the alternative energies thing is a scam anyway. I mean, absolute, total scam. I mean, how do you want to deliver the energy by solar plates or by these, you know, these air wind, you know, these wheels? I don't know the word in English, but I mean, it depends.
Wind turbines.
I mean, first they don't do much. They kill birds and insects by thousands. They destroy the landscape. Some people earn money from it, but the energy they produce is not much. And also the solar panels, I mean, you have to have good weather. So I don't see a serious proposition what to do when you get out of fossil fuels and all that. I just don't see it. So I can't tell what's going on here. And I mean, I also see, I mean, this would be another 2 hours we can talk about, you know. But I also can see that radical environmentalists are on one way being pushed by World Economic Forum. On the other hand, they are made to look their climate policies more sane, if you see what I mean. I mean, they're
a sort of cartoonish, controlled opposition.
I think so. I mean, some months ago, I wrote a piece about this Swedish environmentalist, and honestly, his name is escaping me by now, but he has written this book, How to Blow Up a Pipeline, you see, and it has been translated into German, and there's a German female environmentalist, she's the German Greta Thunberg, no, and she's just as silly and astroturfed. And she would make a joke on some climate conference that, oh, we are planning to blow up a pipeline in Africa. So, and then all the boomers,
oh my god,
yeah, all the boomer right wingers would freak out and say, oh, look, she's a terrorist. And that was ridiculous. And then she said she was referring to this book by the Swedish environmentalist who's advocating actual acts of terrorism, not against people, of course, but against things, you see. And then I looked up what else he's thinking about. And he's, of course, a total Marxist and total woke. And he also believes that climate change is related to racism because only racist white people are responsible for it. And I mean, he does have some, he is convinced that if we continue with the fossil fuel civilization, there will be a huge, horrible collapse. So there has to be a communist-style occupation of companies and of factories and so to make a change. And then I thought, okay, and then what? What is the next thing you will do? And then you can see, for example, look, when he's talking about French, the Yellow Vests, I guess you remember the Yellow Vests, they protested because the fuel prices went up. And there were all these people from the periphery of the big cities, and they needed their cars to go to their workplaces. They couldn't afford it, you know. The climate policies of the government, they were not respecting these people, this middle or proletarian class people who needed the cars to get to work, you know. And so they had these huge protests. And I remember the Swedish guy addressing this, and then he suggested the solution would be to get them all electric bicycles or to get them into buses, you see? So you don't have to a car for everybody, but you have a bus to take them to work, and you have electric bicycles. And of course, this is absolutely silly. It's crazy, you see?
And yeah, it's unrealistic.
Yeah, yeah. And the next thing is... not to go too deep into this, but if you take this thing serious, if you think, okay, climate change is happening and fossil fuels are leading to a civilizational collapse, the only honest thinker who thought, there are a few others, okay, but Pentti Linkola, the Finnish deep ecologist, or Ted Kaczynski, these were the only people who seriously thought this to the end. I mean, I'm not saying that they are right about everything they said, but their proposals they made how to solve this, you know, they are logical. They're logical. If overpopulation of the planet is leading to collapse and leading to huge animal problems, you have to reduce the population. And nobody would be as honest as Pentti Linkola and say, yeah, you should just kill 2/3 of the population with bombs or with viruses or so. You see what I'm getting at?
Maybe with vaccines.
I mean, you see what I'm getting at. So there's some strange thing going on here with this whole climate change hysteria. I mean, first, okay, it produces fear porn. It produces state overreach. I mean, of course, states that are controlled by globalist policies. But in the end, what would really happen is it just won't save the environment. It just will extend the control Absolutely. They have over people, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I think this is
immediately shown by the fact that they fly to Davos in their private jets. And I remember seeing something like it was like 100 or 200 private jets had individually flown to Davos or something like that. It was one of the like G7 or G20, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
These are the people tell, and I know it's an obvious point to make and it's a boomer sort of point, but it's true. The fact that they would do that shows you immediately they aren't really bothered about the environment. There's just no way that they could easily carpool, they could jet pool, you know, they could just share each other's jets and fly together, but no, they don't. So I don't believe any excuse for this. It's massively wasteful. And for the sake of the prestige of arriving in your own jet, I mean, come on, you're supposed to care about the environment. Clearly you don't. And I've said this for years. People talk about climate change and they get worked up. But if they actually believed that what they claim to believe, that we're going to burn, that everything's going to be lost, the ice caps are melting, cities are going to be flooded, all the rest of it. If they actually believed that, they would be scared shitless. They would be hysterical with fear and worry about it. But they're not. Even Greta Thunberg isn't. And, you know, I think she would believe whatever she was told. But even she isn't really. I mean, I don't believe it. So the fact that they're not really scared tells me that
like
this
COVID.
Is all bullshit.
Well, like in COVID.
Similar. That's a different thing because the public, I think, kind of did believe it wholeheartedly and kind of didn't believe it at the same simultaneously. And I think it's similar with climate change, but the public aren't the ones I'm talking about. I'm referring to the people who are spreading this stuff. They don't really seem scared or worried. So I find it hard to believe that that what they're saying is true, or that even they even believe it themselves.
Yeah. Well, this is what I mean, that it seemed that the elites were not that scared about COVID. You know? some levels below, people were really scared and hysterical, but we have proofs when they have private meetings, they're not having their masks on, it's just theater. So you had really quickly the impression that the elites who were enforcing these policies themselves were not really that scared of it, you see? And the same thing with climate change, I guess.
Yeah, and especially when they were going to their conferences and parties and stuff and not wearing the masks.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
this happened
come
often.
On. Yeah, I mean, it's grotesque. It's so obvious that it, and someone just said you'd think that they would do this stuff just for optics' sake, that like they wouldn't have their private jets and whatever. But even with the COVID stuff, they didn't even do that for they didn't even care, you know. So they're clearly not worried. And I remember seeing a really sickening thing recently, actually, because this is still about COVID. And it was like a month, 2 months ago. It was that one where there was the famous photo came out of Justin Trudeau, Rishi Sunak and Klaus Schwab. And they're all wearing these costumes. And in the background, people are wearing, like the servants, the waiters are wearing masks. And it was so disgusting because, and there were similar ones as well from Britain, from Downing Street a year and a half ago. But it's so disgusting to think that it's like the servants are filthy. The servants are low class. They carry diseases, so they've got to wear masks. But we in the elite, we don't have to wear masks because we're not filthy. We're not low class. It's really very distasteful and ugly. And it points to, as you were saying about Yuval Harari and so on, that they very much see themselves as separate from the general public, separate from the hoi polloi, almost a different life form from the rest of us.
Yeah, what's puzzling is that they don't care about the optics anymore. I mean, they're publishing these photos. And it doesn't look good. I mean, they look like feudal lords, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, look, we should really wrap up now because I know, and someone's saying this should go on for ages, and I know it should, and I wish it could. But I have to get the Golden Age Man is coming on next. So,
okay.
The last thing you wanted to talk about is what you're working on just now. So please tell everyone about that.
Oh, well, so I have just a few time left. So two things. First, my book about ethno-pluralism will be translated into English now. It has not been officially announced. It's a Danish publishing house. And I'm very happy that the translator will be Roger Devlin, which was my personal wish. I have been in contact with Roger for quite a while now. Yes, and there will be an English version of it and released next year, and I'll be very happy to see it. And I think I will write an extra update just for the English version. And the second thing is, this would be another stream, like I'm about to do a book about, let's say, 100 films seen from the right, in a way, you know. But I was struggling hard to find a new grab on it, which would be quite different from... You know, there have been attempts like to have film reviews from the right, so you can, you know, find things in the movies that concern us or attract people who are interested in it. You had, for example, these white nationalist guides to the cinema, Trevor Lynch and so. And these were all interesting efforts, but I was looking for something different. And so I'll try to pick up about 100 movies to deal with things that are of concern for the right, like, I don't know, nationalism, like dystopianism, religion, and all that. But I also want to consider it from a historical perspective. So the movies may date way back into the 1920s, and you have to, you know, be aware how the zeitgeist changed, how movies mirror the zeitgeist, what's going on, or how movies sometimes produce the zeitgeist. But this is an endless issue, and maybe we do an extra stream about it. But this is the book project I'm working on.
Oh, that sounds great. People are asking in the live chat whether you're on Telegram or Gab. Martin doesn't have a Telegram or a Gab yet, but I know that he's fully intending to rectify that. And when that does happen, I will link to both of them from my own Telegram channel. So that will be advertised. So Okay, well, this has been another really good stream, Martin. So thank you very much for doing that. I'll be back imminently with the Golden Age Man. But in the meantime, Martin Lichtmes, thank you for appearing on Millennial.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Excellent. Okay, I'll be back soon. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.